Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name is Chad Kim. This week I'll be talking with Ty Paul Monroe, and we'll be talking about his book, Putting on Christ, Augustine's Early Theology of Salvation and the Sacraments. Ty Monroe is a professor at Assumption College, and I was happy to talk with him a little bit about his reading of Augustine and this great book that came out that has a lot of similarities with my work, but maybe a deeper theological dive than even I go into on my book on Augustine. So this was a chance for two Augustine scholars to kind of go in deep, do a deep dive on Augustine and his work on humility. So thanks, Ty, for being on the show. I would also like to say a thank you and a shout out to Dove Cameron, and he wrote on our podcast page on Apple Podcast, an amazing part of my journey in Christ. Thank you for these incredibly informative and often edifying podcasts, hugely helpful interviews. Little Gale says, well worth your time and listenership. I've learned so much about the historicity of the Christian faith and the church. Thanks, Chad, Tom, Trevor, and all the guests. And so we just had some really great comments. We are also, as you may be aware, we are releasing episodes on our Patreon now. And the Patreon is where we'll have the conversations between Tom, Trevor, and Chad. And so I appreciate all of our new supporters. We have Judy Gale is a new supporter. And then Catherine Rakes is a new supporter. So if you want to hear those conversations between Tom, Trevor, and Chad, those will be on the Patreon from here on out. And we are going to release one soon, and that's going to be on the Acts of Thomas, and that'll be a little bit about the story about how Christianity goes from the Middle East, from Israel, all the way to India, and sort of the early documents of Christianity in India. So please do support us on Patreon, and you can have access to those episodes. And we're going to begin to put the back catalog of episodes on the Patreon as well. So for just $3 a month, you can support us. You can get those episodes. You can get the back episodes. And so there's a lot on there to offer. So I do suggest you go on there. And that's also how you can help us keep this podcast alive, and all the different costs for hosting and various things, as well as paying a little bit for Grant to do his work. Have a lot to coming forward. We are having some interviews with Drew Johnson on evolution and the Bible, actually Grant's going to be on that episode. Be sure to keep out and keep a lookout for what's coming down the stream. Sorry that these are a little delayed. It has been some time since the last episode, but there's also been a lot going on at school and various things. So that's a really long intro. Please do support us on Patreon. We appreciate it. And without further ado, my conversation with Ty Paul Monroe. All right. Well, this morning on A History of Christian Theology, I am talking with Ty Paul Monroe and his book, Putting on Christ, Augustine's Early Theology of Salvation and the Sacraments, it came out maybe a year ago, a year or two ago.
August of 22, yep.
August of 22. So I'm a little behind in the game, but Catholic University Press was kind enough to provide me with a copy. And as my listeners will know, I love Augustine. I was happy to talk with Ty and I'm happy to talk with Ty and was excited to get him to come on, because his book here, he deals with humility, which is a question that I raise a lot in my preaching work. But he takes it from a more precise theological, perhaps philosophical tack. And so, his is a great book, a deep dive, and a very well-constructed argument about what is going on as Augustine thinks about salvation and its relationship to humility. So pleased to have you, Ty.
Thank you so much, Chad. I really appreciate that. And you may have a slightly higher estimation of my work than I do, but it means a lot to me. So I'm glad you enjoyed the book, and I'm actually honored to be here today and to chat with you about Augustine and other things. So Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and so, yeah, so we'll talk about the book. I do have one question that I've already talked with Ty a little bit about, some other stuff that he's written. Just, again, sort of curious questions for me. But we'll start with the book itself. So one of the central ideas is in the book is about the power of the sacraments, especially baptism, for Augustine in the confession. So can you give a quick kind of working definition of how he understands the sacraments and walk us through when he comes to that understanding?
Yeah, sure. I'm glad to do that. So it's interesting. If you kind of look for a standard take like on the Augustinian definition take on sacraments, you'll get Augustine defines a sacrament as a visible sign of invisible grace. And if you actually go looking for that as a citation, it's actually kind of hard to find. I think it's a good rough and ready beginning of a definition, kind of read through medieval appropriations of Augustine, and it's not a false one. But what I try to suggest in the book, in keeping with the trajectory of scholarship done by people before me, a few different authors before me, like Michael Cameron, whom you and I both have met and know a little bit, is that for the mature Augustine, I think sacraments are an active human response to and participation in Christ's work through physical rituals and signs. Mm-hmm. That participatory kind of structure to the sacramental activity, I think, is it's easy to, well, maybe not easy, but it's easy to miss if you're just thinking them as of them as visible signs of invisible grace. They are that because they are maybe more deeply participation in Christ's own work. And so because of that, they're really important to his theology of grace and his soteriology, his theology of salvation more generally. Mm-hmm. What I try to do in the book is suggest that Confessions, which is a text so many of us know really well and have read, which some scholars have read through a sacramental lens, but oftentimes it's not really read that way. I sort of suggest that if you pay attention to sacramentality and specific sacraments like baptism in the text, it reveals a kind of snapshot of, if not the most mature or the most fully developed Augustine, the fairly mature Augustine's take on that participatory efficacy and that participatory meaning of sacraments. So then because I use that and the dating right on Confessions is a little bit fuzzy, but most the consensus is around 400, right, that he finishes it then. Then the question becomes, and for me from a research perspective, the question was first, how does the early Augustine think about sacraments, and how does he think about salvation? How does he think about Christ and Christology and the intersection of Christology and soteriology? And so the book attempts to sort of tell a bit of a story of first what that kind of mature participatory understanding of sacramental activity and efficacy is in the Confessions, and then to kind of rewind a little bit and go back to the beginning of Augustine, or the extant writings of Augustine, and say what did it look like then. Mm-hmm. So we can talk more about that sort of early, the take on the early Augustine that I give. But I think that the development that he exhibits is real. I think there's a real change. I try to steer clear of saying that there's like radical discontinuity or radical continuity, mm-hmm. and try to sort of kind of sketch a via media mm-hmm. in which he does take sacraments not only more seriously, I guess you could say, but has a thicker and more complex account of what they are in their relation to Christ. Mm-hmm. But that the stakes of that investigative developmental argument aren't, you know, was he a Christian early on? Was he seriously a Christian early on? And did he like then become a Christian, or did he never change his mind at all? And you can find, those are caricatures, but you can find scholarly representations of Augustine's development that pitch in those really dramatic extremes. Yeah. And I wanted to say, no, the stakes aren't quite that high. And yet the development was real. So, of course.
I mean, you wrote a book on it, so much there. But for some reason, the one that I'm keying in on, the question that raises for me, is one that came up. We just met each other at this Patristics Medieval and Renaissance conference. Yeah. And another guy that is doing his doctorate at SLU was talking about this question of like how tightly is Augustine connected to his Platonic and philosophical forebears? I bring that up only to say, because it seems like with the definition of sacraments, it's almost a lot about how he understands language. Mm-hmm. And where you have this question of, do signs really do things or not? And so in the same way that sign is tightly connected to sacrament, where there are questions about whether or not he's a pure epistemological Platonist, that you can never learn anything through signs. You can only like relearn what was once known in a sort of pre-existent state or something. And so it seems like, you know, that's not, I know that that's taking it in a slightly different direction, but there's still that same question. And I feel like I have a tendency to want to push on one particular scholar who has, so Philip Carey has been on the podcast.
Yeah, I figured that's where we were going. Yeah.
And so Philip Carey has been on the podcast. So I mean, he and I are, I don't know him super well again, but he has a view that like, it's just exactly what Augustine says in De Magistro, that you can't know things through signs. Right. And it seems like that's what's happening with sacraments. Do the sacraments actually do the thing? And that's, is that kind of part of your question? Like, does Augustine actually think that a sacrament does something?
It's a great question, Chad. And the funny thing about it is I first met Philip Carey at either PMR or NAPS about 10 years ago. and just starting to get to know his work, I got really worked up. Like I was like, no, I can't. And for listeners who don't know, your sketch, your précis of his argument, which again, it is based on a reading of a certain strain of Neoplatonism, right?
Yep.
In which you might think of it as hierarchical or sort of downward causality. Spiritual and material realities cause things for, you know, sort of maybe horizontally, but definitely downward, right? A spiritual reality can cause something in the lower physical register in the hierarchy of being, but not the inverse, right?
And so I like the way that you put that. Yeah, that's
yeah. So Carey sort of takes that and runs with it and says a couple things, right? One, Augustine says things, especially in his early works, that seem to exhibit a certain affinity with that kind of one-way street form of hierarchical a version of Neoplatonic causality. Number two, and this is where the question of like, what does Augustine really think and how is it related to, let's say, a very full-fledged medieval or early modern or even Reformation understanding of sacramental efficacy? And by that, I mean specifically somebody like Luther, who, you know, if Carey lingers in the background of my work or your work, it's fair to say maybe Luther lingers in the background of Carey's work, which is fine, right?
Yeah, and he actually says as much in what is Protestant theology. Yeah,
exactly. So anyway, so there are a lot of different like cross sections there, right? But Carey sort of suggests, okay, well, if we can't find in Augustine a kind of fully articulated and exemplified understanding of some sort of objective realist account of sacramental efficacy that can be the catalyst, it can be the sort of the prime mover in a case of conversion, maybe not even in his own conversion, right? Then we have to sort of put that, you know, sort of be honest about that and put that together and say it really is the case that let's say Plotinian, right, maybe Porphyrian, but Plotinian understanding of causality is really underlying all of the seemingly metaphorically beautiful and seemingly realist, so to speak, things he says about the sacraments. So how does my work intersect with that? Aside from the fact that I think I only name Carey once or twice in the book, but that's because I think by that point I had kind of like, you know, I met him a few times. We had some great discussions. I think we were on a panel once or something like that at PMR. And he's a super, super generous person. I really like Phil. My work intersects with it in one way, but I think I would also say that, and I don't want to disparage his like scholarship of late ancient Christianity, but I mean, there are strains of Neoplatonic thinking in which physical signs, you think of the iamblican tradition, right? Theurgic and ritual activities do have the capacity, right, to shape and form their human subjects. And that attempt, right, to sort of give an account of the way that these, in the pagan context, right, these pagan practices were physical ritual practices, and Amblicus and others, right, are trying to synthesize and say, well, if that's the case, then there has to be some, and I'm no scholar of Neoplatonism, and I'm not going to, you know, sort of pretend to be. So there's that question, right? Are all Neoplatonic theories of causality and ritual or sacramental, so to speak, efficacy the same? Probably not. But my tack was to go a different direction and to say, if we think about the narrative and the organic existential structure of the story that Augustine tells in Confessions, there's something going on there that the sacramental moments of, especially baptism, I would argue in book 9, which I actually happen to be teaching right this morning to my undergrads. Book 9's very short, et baptizati sumus, right? And then we were baptized, actually is a sort of terse, but maybe telling summary of actually what's happened throughout the first 8 books, and especially in the conversion in book 8. And that matters, right? And it matters also the contours of the journey that lead Augustine there. And there's a few like things in the Confessions narrative that I sort of say, you know, if the sacrament doesn't do something for Augustine that his own revelatory moments of insight can't do, or that he can't do with those, then what's going on? Mm-hmm. Those include his claim in book 9 that quite plainly and simply his sins had not been forgiven yet until he had been baptized. Mm-hmm. That might seem like a small thing, but we often read book 8 as the conversion moment, right? As like, now he's a Christian. And he says in book 9, more or less, I think in pretty plain terms, no, I wasn't. I was headed there, right? But there was something yet to complete. He also implies, and I agree with Michael Cameron on this. He also implies that baptism will initiate him into a whole network of signs and rituals, like reading the Psalms and the voice of Christ and things like that. That entire sacramental economy, to use a, you know, maybe anachronistic word, that's going to be essential for his ongoing conversion and salvation. And then there's the whole, again, the contours of his existential, you know, journey, which mm-hmm. is to say, if learning certain informational, you know, content and propositional content, illuminating as it was, let's say in book 7, were enough to get him across the finish line, then what's going on in book 8 with the division of the will? And then the other part to this, right, is to say, okay, so does he think then in those earlier texts, the Kosciuszkan Dialogues and Honor, does he think of it in the kind of Philip Carey De Magistro Platinian way? I'm not so sure, but what I do stake my claim on in the first, in the third and fourth chapters of the book is that because his account of salvation is itself simplistic, and I would say narrowly intellectualist. I wouldn't say, I think he's an intellectualist in the broadest sense that intellect moves the will, but in the sense of like information is what moves people forward. It moves their will forward in pretty plain and simple ways. What I call the sort of linear account of intellect and will causality. Mm. He has that pretty simplistic soteriology in his earlier texts. The sacraments neatly slot into that. And whenever the few times he actually talks about the sacred signs or sacraments in the early texts, it seems like they just are instrumental means to enlightenment and the revelation of basic truths. And I think when you get to the Confessions, that model isn't working anymore for a variety of, I think, personal, pastoral, and philosophical, theological reasons. So maybe that's too far afield, but yeah.
No, it's not far afield. I, you know, again, as ever, you've summarized a lot and really well, and it resonates with other things that I'm kind of working on reading. When you started saying that, like the sort of idea of sacramental efficacy and moving the way that you talk about how it instigates the will, moves forward the will from something mm-hmm. lower to something higher, perhaps in the Plotinian scheme. It just reminded me that. One of the questions that I've kind of been dipping my toe in the water is Augustine's use of Porphyry's question about universal salvation, and in that sense, not as in all, which you know, but not as in all shall be saved, but as in a means by which all can come to salvation. And he, there's a typology that comes up. What is it? Book 10 in the City mm-hmm. of God, yep. Where he tries to draw on Porphyry and say there are three different means mm-hmm. to move forward, and one of them is a kind of theurgistic or ritual driven soteriology. And so I think he definitely wants to appropriate that and say that you know, it's not just him who can do the kind of Plotinian ascent, but his mother too, and maybe she doesn't have the same education that he does. And so what is it that can push her forward? If for him it's a little more, as you say, intellectualist, he knows that it's not that way for everyone. Right. And so the sacraments must do something.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And the interesting thing, and I'm glad you brought up book 10, because actually one of the closest that I've found that quotes that Augustine gets to in, you know, invisible, a visible sign of an invisible grace or an inward thing, is when he says that the Eucharist, right, is a visible, it's a visible sign of an invisible sacrifice, right? But more to the point of where you're going with this on Porphyry, Porphyry, I mean, Augustine loves to find in City of God, he loves to find an opponent who sort of gets it and then waffles on the truth, like waffles on the take that he wants.
Yeah.
Because he can say, not only are you wrong, but you're wrong, but while also being right. And the reason you're not willing to actually be right is because there's the pride and humility dialectic, right? There's a pride and humility. So it's Porphyry's vacillating. Because even, I mean, I don't know what the consensus is, but I mean, Augustine's take is that that Porphyry vacillated precisely on whether like rituals actually were worthwhile, and also like if everyone needed them. I mean, Augustine's take is you think you don't need them, right? You think there isn't one universal way because you don't need it, and you're gonna. And John Cavadini's piece on I think it's from about 8 to 10 years ago in Modern Theology on Book 10 is really fantastic on this, right? It's There's a socio-political element to it precisely because Porphyry's willing to stratify the community. He's willing to sort of have an in and out crowd on his terms because it feeds Augustine's take as it feeds his pride, right? So, yeah, I mean, the take that I'm trying to offer on Confessions is that Augustine may have needed, and he suggests that he needed, the intellectual insights provided by the books of the Platonists, but not for the reasons that might seem initially to be the case, right? Mm. One, he says precisely because the order that he read that and then read scripture actually sort of like set him up to fail in like a healthy way, right? And another reason is precisely what you said, is that the ascent narratives in book 7 are not the ascent narrative in book 9. And it's the equalizer is incorporation into Christ, right? Which Monica have, even if Monica doesn't have, like you say, a grasp on even a kind of like Milanese Neoplatonic Christianity, let alone Platonism, Neoplatonism itself. So that aspect of the moral character of formation and what I want to suggest, I guess, in the book is that sacraments provide a sort of a way of knowing, right? Mm-hmm. Or a way of the formation of the intellect and will that basic informational propositional content can't do or doesn't do by itself or doesn't always do. And again, his story as being evidence of this, in fact, that when he gets the most amount of, intellectual philosophical insight in book 7, he's actually tragically the most incapable of actually, I mean, it's weird, right? Because he's close.
Yeah,
and he says in the beginning of book 8, I don't doubt anymore. And this is where I kind of, my take on book 8 is different than the very eminent and incredibly learned Sarah Byers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I take her, I don't know if you've read her book on Stoic perception and moral sensibility in Augustine, but she gives a more straightforwardly intellectualist reading of the conversion scene in book 8, which is to say there are things that Augustine doesn't fully know. Like he doesn't know that it will be good for him. It's sort of like the final step of intellectually motivated moral motivation. And then when the doubt disappears, that's actually like new. I take her to be saying that's new informational content. And what I suggest is it is and it isn't, because he seems to suggest at the beginning of book 8, there's really nothing new to learn. But that coming to know that this is what I should do and I'm actually going to do it first it's grace, right? Because we have the workings, we have the sort of the beginnings of that later, what Burns will call an operative account of grace already at work in Confessions, something that comes from outside of him that he doesn't do for himself and all that, right? But that it moves him again towards baptism, and baptism is going to form him in a way that nothing else that he's read or understood or been told can do for him.
Yeah.
But that requires humility, right? To say, I need this, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and One thing that we were putting together in one of the sessions at PMR, I found PMR so energizing this year.
It's a great conference.
I usually do, but especially so this year.
Kevin Hughes debt for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, you talked about like that. Just so getting to this role of humility here, one of the things that that Porphyry didn't have that Victor Inus has, is the humility to go and receive the sacrament. And he doesn't think, I think he uses the phrase courage to humility. And there was a gentleman who gave a paper, and now his name is escaping me, where we were kind of talking about this in one of the sessions. But so I guess we could think a little bit about one of the questions that I had for you is, so what is the relationship between salvation and conversion? You know, we've been talking about books seven, eight, and nine, and book seven, he seems to get something intellectually. Book eight is the divided will, but then book nine is the sacrament, and then the ostia sent. So how do conversion and salvation work in there?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, this sort of will probably get me into talking about the other main angle that the book tries to take, which is to say, not only does Augustine move from a more simplistic and a thinner account of sacramental efficacy in the early work to a thicker, more complex account in Confessions, and what is that account? But then the other layer is, how does he get there, right? And the story I try to tell, I don't know how good of a job I do of it, is to sort of go back into some texts that are really not heavily studied, at least in modern, current Anglophone Augustine scholarship, which are texts from the mid to late 390s, his New Testament commentaries and things like that. And to say, like, actually what's going on here is Augustine's kind of ramping up in a way, whether he knows it or not, to kind of fight the anti-Donatist battle. Mm-hmm. And he's already fighting it, but he's really kind of ramping that up. And offering competing accounts of grace and sacramental efficacy and trying out different theories in the mid to late 390s. And then that's going to parlay, I think, into, and in ways that I find both great and sometimes challenging to me theologically, but it's going to parlay into the Pelagian controversy. And so all of that is kind of in play here. You know, as to Confessions in particular, I would add, right, that, you know, like you say, seven is a kind of intellectual, at least enlightenment, if not conversion. Eight is the wrestling of a kind of a moral conversion, maybe. And then nine is a kind of baptism and sacramental efficacy. Well, then 10, right, is also, you know, that's where the continuity between conversion and salvation comes to the fore. Because in some sense, I think you could argue that for the mature slash later Augustine, there is a kind of distinction between conversion and the ongoing work of salvation. But I think in his best moments, and I think the way that I would want to read him is, while they may be distinct moments, they are continuous in their character, right? Which is to say, it is initially formation in and incorporation to and by, or, you know, Christ's own humility, right? You participate in Christ's humility. And then that's the name of the game for, as book 10 suggests, the rest of his life, right? I mean, teaching book 10 on Monday to my undergrads, and, you know, already some of them are, you know, the first few books, they're like, this guy was a bishop and he's a saint. We all call him Saint Augustine. And, you know, he's telling the story of his life. And I always say, like, yeah, he might be exaggerating. He probably wasn't as bad as he wants you to believe, but yeah, he was, you know,
that impulse is surprising.
Exactly. Well, and I say to them, even the willingness to admit it, right, to talk about it. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I let Augustine have his moment, and sort of say, like, you know, he clearly did have a problem with his libido, and that's an important part of the story. There've been years I've not taught book 10 just because of the constraints of time in the semester and all that. Yeah. And this year I want to go back to teaching it, because it really does sort of put the capstone on the Augustinian account of soteriology and salvation and sacramental efficacy in the book, because it is a story of the ongoing of moral formation and conversion that he continues to require in the present day. Like, there's no narrative in book 10, but the narrative is, this is my struggle every day.
Yeah.
And that book ends with him saying, right, I'm going to keep offering the sacrament of the altar, just like I offered it from the end of book 9 for my mom and remembered her at the altar. I have to keep offering the price of my salvation for myself and for my parishioners. And that's in light of the fact that I keep being gluttonous, and I keep, you know, I keep struggling with the desire for glory and fame and people to approve of me. And I keep, you know, struggling to let my emotions get the best of me when I'm singing in church and all these other things in book 10. Right. So, maybe that's a long-winded non-answer, but, I do think that especially as Augustine moves toward, you know, he sort of tries to close the door on the Donatist controversy. And then of course he turns right around and runs into the Pelagian controversy sort of in full force in 411 and onward. I do think that there's a way in which the theology of grace that begins to get sketched out in 396 or so in the Ad Simplicianum and the Answers to Simplicius, where at least the initial movement of grace has to be something that's wholly kind of without you. It's external to you. Your will is dead. You don't really, I don't think that you contribute anything to it in that, in what the medievals would call the initium fidei, right? Mm-hmm. I still do think that there's a way in which it bears with it that character of humility and submission, if for no other reason that once you are converted, right? Like once you've had the moment of the, let's say that the conversion scene in book 8 more or less tracks with what he's going to do later in the Anti-Pelagian controversy. That grace comes first. It does something for you that you can't do. And it's kind of inexplicable. Mm-hmm. You still look back on it as a person who's going on through ongoing moral conversion. And your response, your cooperative and participatory response includes your memory of and your thankfulness for that. At the same time, I do think that conversion as that initial movement of grace that does for you what you cannot do is different in the sense that everything else from that point on is cooperative. It's doing something for you that you can't do, but what it's doing for you, which you can't do, is enabling you to cooperate as well, right? It's enabling you to respond.
Yeah.
So you could maybe say, well, that's true even in the initial moment of conversion. But I think in Augustine's, you know, most coherent moments, it's all, you know, humility leading to charity. It's all, I don't think it's voluntarist in the sense that it's inexplicable why I chose this over something else, mm-hmm. right? It is the movement of the intellect and the will together toward a rational end, right? Toward true happiness, toward the true good that I, you know, that my intellect and will were aiming at nothingness, you know, until that moment. So
right.
I don't know, that's kind of a complicated and maybe messy answer, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that distinction between conversion and salvation. And
no, well, I mean, so, it's well, I don't know if I have a solid answer either. I just have lots of questions.
Yeah.
And it's well, I wanted to go when you asked me to respond, I find myself as a, like, my intellectual formation is a little bit peculiar. Yeah. But like I basically did an undergrad in analytic philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was philosophy, but all of our professors were analytics. So the one thing that was always really helpful is they were like, define this term, define that term.
Right, yeah.
And so what I hear you saying is, well, you know,
yeah.
I'm not opposed to that at all. It's one of those things that's like, on the one hand, it's helpful intellectually to be able to try to put the building blocks together.
Yeah.
But then the difficult thing is, but it's not always as simple. And especially with someone like Augustine, this is the difficulty. Like I'm teaching confessions to an online group of kind of like pastor, you know, kind of people. So a little more theologically educated than my undergrads. So I'm having to go deeper.
Right.
But one of the things that I repeatedly tell them is you have to pay attention to Augustine in his metaphors, in his images. Right. And you have to always remember he is being a rhetorician while also being a theologian, which is not what Aquinas is or something like that. So, you know, and there's a reason contemporary analytics like Aquinas and so there may be a more of a precision there. So I think in any of these questions, just so this is, you know, maybe this is a lot of throat clearing, but it's like one of the things that's difficult with Augustine is part of me wants to like, tell me exactly what you mean by this.
Right. Go ahead. I mean, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about sort of bringing Aquinas into this, not because I'm not a scholar of Aquinas, although, I wrote a master's thesis on him that was pretty bad. And now I've published on him and I'm sure I'm going to get some flack for what I've published on him, because I'm sure that the Thomists will say I didn't understand him correctly in my critique of him. But he's great on this because he's going to tell you the best that he can using Aristotelian, usually using Aristotelian terminology to make sense of what he means by the conversion of the intellect and the will, right? Mm-hmm. And so if memory serves me correctly, Aquinas is going to do everything that he can to say, especially, I would argue, the later Aquinas, who's read a lot more of the later Augustine than maybe the early Aquinas, he's going to say, in a sense, that initial movement of grace that converts the will and the intellect, really, but converts the will to want God fully and to choose God, not just to have a natural desire for God, but actually choose the supernatural end. That first movement has to be, grace has to be first. And there's no merit. So this is where the questions of cooperation and merit kind of run up against each other, right? Because if you want to say, in a sense, it's cooperative all the way down, which you can read, sometimes you can read not only the early Augustine on this, but you can actually read the Ad Simplicianum this way and say, when Augustine says that God will choose whomever he wants and he'll choose apart from merit, but he'll choose in such a way that elicits the will, it seems to suggest, right, that there's already cooperation from ground zero, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Augustine wants to say that, but the worry of both Augustine and the later, if not the Aquinas in entirety of his career, is that question of, or at least I think this is the question that they wonder about, is saying it's cooperative all the way down, does that imply a kind of, not meriting, but a kind of meriting, right?
Yeah.
That fails to put the primacy of grace first. Now, on a normative level, I don't think that that's the case, but that's also because I have other views about salvation and grace and free will. So Augustine will try to say that nothing is moved by a higher agent in a way. I mean, if it's the gift of grace is to free your will, then it has to free you in such a way that it makes you free. It doesn't necessarily do something for you in a kind of mechanistic way. Mm. And I forget. I think that's one of the spots where he uses the, maybe not. I don't know if it's where he uses the arrow and the sort of final causality has to, but it also, physical premotion is what the Thomists call it. Like, it has to actually give you the capacity to respond, and that giving you the capacity to respond makes it a not like just a, like a one-way street where you're sort of robotically just forced to do it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that initial, the sort of the complete death of the will, the complete inability of the will to bring anything to the table, merit or otherwise, does sort of force a kind of initial extrinsic or external primacy to grace that always, for I think for both Augustine and Aquinas, needs to cash out in cooperative like agency and participation.
Yeah.
The question is, how does that initial moment of extrinsic or external, and then when it's limited, if it's limited, yeah. Augustine it is,
right,
then that raises other questions about the meaning and of grace in that initial moment. So
yeah,
that's a messy, again, another messy, poorly said way.
No, I don't think it was. So there's so much that I want to respond to. I did want to ask you something about the limited nature eventually. But one of the things, just to go back to something you said before about book 10, and one of the things that I've been emphasizing, for this class that I've been teaching on the Confessions is the healing nature or healing memory. And so you were talking about what happens at that initial moment. And even if there is, to use the Initium Fidei, even if there's some confusion or imprecision about exactly what, starts the train moving or whatever, Augustine, the whole project of the Confessions is a healing, as healing his memories, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there, you're right to say that there's something about, what you need to do when he's plumbing the depths of these memories, he's trying to make sense of it.
Right.
And he's trying to come to terms with it. And one of the phrases that he uses is healing memories. And which also one of the questions that I'm kind of working through myself is the centrality of these metaphors for of healing, physician. Yeah. I find all that, it's something that like you use. Another person who I've been reading, who I hope to interview soon, is Han Luen Kanzer-Kamlin.
Yeah, she's great.
The will. And, it's like, we all make this reflexive use of Augustine or when we're talking about Augustine with healing.
Yeah.
But what, how does that work? How does that metaphor work for Augustine is kind of something I've been wondering.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I guess we could put it in a register of the questions that we've been asking. You know, on the one hand, there is some kind of extrinsic healing that, mm-hmm. that seems to go on in right. the power of the sacrament. There is also an internal healing that's ongoing as he's trying to understand. But I don't know. Could you, you know, yeah. respond something on that? Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're going to try to have Han Luen on, because she'll clean up all my imprecision about talking about Augustine on the will in the beginning and onward. But so healing is... you're right. I mean, Christ as the medicus, and the sacraments he calls medicine, right?
Yeah.
Medicina or medicina. I think this is, you know, one of the aspects of Augustine's theological anthropology and soteriology that make him so wonderful to teach, whether to undergrads or, like you say, folks that you're teaching. I mean, it really shows Augustine's pastoral sensibilities, but it also is because it shows his human sensibility and his sensibility for the existential threat, right, that sin is. Mm-hmm. Sin is problematic for Augustine, not because it's the breaking of a rule, although it's the breaking of a rule, right? It's yeah. problematic because it's bad for you, right? It warps you. It makes you ill. So I think that healing motif accords with Augustine's attempt to talk about or to show through his own life story that sin is self-destructive and that it's absurd. Mm. Right? It's paradoxical. This is what I tell students: like, it's paradoxically absurd that what you really want is God, right? That you're wired and your heart is wired to be restless until it finds God, and yet you can tragically, and we do tragically, search for God / happiness / the good / truth and beauty and right on all these and true existence, true life, through all the things that we search for, just like Augustine did. My go-to metaphor when I talk to students about Augustine's understanding of sin, especially when he's talking about grief and things like that, but especially when he's talking about lust, right? And his own disjunctive proposition between being baptized, being a Christian, and also being celibate versus not, right? And sort of talk to them and say, like, why? I mean, does Augustine think that you can't, you know, be married and be a Christian? And, you know, a few of them will go, yeah, yeah. And then they'll be like, no, he doesn't think that. Obviously, he doesn't think that. So I'm like, so why for him is it cold turkey? Like, why for it? And we talk about the pathologies of addiction, right? We talk about the ways yep. in which, and unfortunately, right, we almost everyone knows somebody on some level who is addicted to something. And some of us are in fact maybe addicted to screens or whatever, but this notion that
I was addicted to cigarettes for 15 years. So yeah, I use that as my go-to. What is that like? What does that mean?
Right. Yeah. What is it like, first of all, to do something? Well, what is it like to be compelled to do something that you not only kind of know is not good for yep. you, but you also kind of don't want to do?
Right.
Like, in your best moments, you can have divided will.
Yep.
What is that power? And you talk about memory, right? What is the power of habituation that he sort of so clearly diagnoses in book 8? When those voices come back and say, you're really going to be without us? Like, you're really going to no longer have that? So the power of memory and that bending of not only the will, and this is what I like try to focus on as much as I can with students, like, not only is my will, my desires, my emotions bent toward a particular end, my intellect is also warped. My intellect has to be warped for my will to be bending in that direction. I have to be seeing double in such a way that there are times or moments or aspects of my perception of reality that really think that that's actually good for me. That really yeah. think. And so that warping and perversion and addiction kind of language and the language of pathology, it's not just a nice way also to diagnose like what it's like to be vicious, right? Or struggling with something in your life that you know you want to get free of. It's also then becomes a great way to talk about salvation and sacramental healing, right? Mm. That the sacraments, the reading for him, reading and reciting scripture, and also right in confessions, being around other people who yep. are, right? Friendship goes from being, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It goes from being something very dangerous for him to then through Monica and Ambrose and Olypius and Abridius and others, Ticianus, it goes to being something that becomes a tool in the hand of the great physician, right? These become you know, sort of nurses and other modes of healing, that other people can form you as well as physical ritual practices can bend those things out, begin to bend those things out of you intellectually and perceptively and appetitively. So I think that's, it's a powerful thing. And I think we could recover something of that in our contemporary dialogue about sin and virtue and vice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so I have a few different angles that I want to go in this. And first I want to do some historical work on Augustine and maybe the broader Christian tradition on that. But yeah, finally, I think, in that sort of like, well, ultimately for me, the question of, the payoff in the contemporary discourse, and I come from, I'm a Protestant, and grew up in a kind of Southern Baptist context, but we love the legal language. And so part of me just wants to say, but we also have this rich tradition of sickness. And that's like, it's one of the weird things. Now, this wasn't a way that I was going to go, but all right, I'm already headed down this track. the issue of sickness and an addiction even is you hurting yourself. And so I don't think Augustine is fully consistent on this because the Christian tradition is going to have both, but often he will say, it's not God just looking to punish you. It's actually God wanting to help you stop hurting yourself. And again, like I said, it's not the entire way that he speaks about it, but he does say it's sort of like God wants to help you and say, quit doing that to yourself, please. And it's not me out there trying to beat you, and whip you for being so bad. No, you're flogging yourself.
Well, my current primary interlocutor from the early church is Gregory of Nyssa, and he is super clear on this. In On the Soul and Resurrection, his dialogue with his sister Macrina, he's very clear about punishment and consequences are fundamentally corrective, redemptive, and healing, right? And I think Augustine, most of the time, and I think that's his, and especially in the pastoral register, and I think definitely in the confessions register, everything that bad that happens to him in the first eight books, he tries to see as providential, right? As contributing toward
a severe mercy.
Exactly. But the other thing that this, and I'm glad you sort of bring it up, the other thing that this sort of relates to is the question of sort of objective and subjective efficacy, right? Both in salvation generally and in sacramental efficacy. And so Augustine gains certain forms, I think, of what we might call juridical kind of forensic or whatever kind of language that that might be more associated with, let's say, the certain Reformed or Protestant traditions. He reads what is it Colossians or whatever, Christ in the writ against us was nailed to the tree, right? And one of the things that leads him to think of the sacraments as doing something beyond revealing to us. And again, Michael Cameron's work is great on this, and Joanne McWilliam Dewart's work is great too, is that Augustine starts to read the letters of Paul and says, there's something out there that's not only juridically against us, but I would argue he also comes close to what sometimes scholars call a physicalist account of salvation and also of sin, right? That sin, you get this a little bit in Athanasius, you do get it somewhat in Gregory of Nyssa and other Eastern fathers, right? It's like a quasi metaphysical or ontological like condition, like it's in human nature, right? So you get some of that in the mid 390s and onward. And he begins to think about the way in which sacraments are doing something out there in the world beyond what they're doing to reveal to me. I think in part because he thinks Christ's death does something beyond that work of revelation. Now, what that opens the door to, I think, is in one direction is you could take that really far, right? And what you could do is you could sort of separate the subjective and the objective. And you can say there are ways in which, and maybe even necessarily, that Christ's death and sacraments have to be understood separate from my subjective response to them. And I understand why, that makes sense in some sense, because it can seem to clarify human and divine agency and the need and also the distinction between divinity and humanity and the dependence of one upon the other. And I understand that, although I think there are reasons to wonder about that strict division. But I think in Augustine, what you get in his best moments as he matures is that he recognizes that objective efficacy, right? Christ does something for humanity that it can't do when he dies on the cross. He nails it to the tree. He defeats death. He essentially kills death by dying, right? Mm-hmm. And that makes possible sacraments, which do things in the world objectively that we can't do for ourselves. But I think most of the time, if not all the time, that the character of that objective efficacy immediately flows into and it's shaped by and it then shapes the subjective appropriation of it, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just, oh, well, cool. You know, there's a divine ledger sheet out there and Christ did something to substitute for it, to pay for it, to atone for it. And my response to it is like, hey, I'm really thankful for that. And I'm glad it happened, right? There's a tighter connection for Augustine, because the work of doing that on Christ's part is itself exemplary. It is a humbling. And so it automatically generates a subjective response that mirrors it, yeah. Even though it can't equal it, even though it didn't cause it. My subjective response didn't cause it, but the character of my subjective response is intimately intertwined with it because it's the same kind of moral shape of it, right? It's humility, it's charity, it's self, it's kenosis, it's self-emptying. And so my response to it is humility, gratitude, charity, and love for God and love for others. So yeah, jury's out for me on sort of juridical forensic language more generally, but I also think it depends on how we correlate it with or think it in conjunction with the subjective response to it on the part of humanity. And I think in Augustine, and this is true too for like his theology of the Eucharist, I think Patu Burns is right, he doesn't have a really worked out explicit account of like transubstantiation or whatever.
Right.
What he usually does is he's realist about it in the sense that it's real because it makes something possible for you in your response to it. There you are on the table. That's the body of Christ. You are the body. Right. Now be yourself. Become what you are. Yep. It's always, almost always correlated with the subjective response to what Christ has already objectively done. And I think I think that's more compelling. I think it's more coherent. Yeah. Than certain alternatives. But yeah, that's where the subjective objective thing I think comes maybe to the fore a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. And you use that subjective and objective language. And that was one thing that I wanted to ask about. So I'm glad you brought that out.
Yeah.
it's helpful in framing some of this for me. So, I found that quite helpful. So, you've got like what, 20, 30 more minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so I'm going to do a hard shift. So usually I put this question in the middle. Listeners tend to like it. So what's just this? So this is a question that I ask a lot of guests. I haven't asked every guest, but I like to ask is what is one thing that you once thought was false and now think is true, mm-hmm. Or vice versa? Right. And I tell people this can be, this can be like you used to be a Cardinals fan and now you're a Cubs fan. I'm from St. Louis, so yeah. I find that, absurd, but. Whatever. It could also be about writing this book. It could be in your intellectual life. We had Scott McKnight on talk about his view on women in ministry and various things. So, this is up to you.
Yeah, sure. I'm a born and bred New Englander, so therefore a diehard Red Sox fan. So like you, I can't imagine becoming a Yankees fan or anything close to it. So, So can I do a twofer maybe?
Sure, go for it.
So I guess there's both they're methodological and substantive answers to this. The methodological or sort of formal answer is that I think I thought when I was baptized as a Catholic as a baby. I was a cradle Catholic. Was never really formed, never really raised in the church. Long story there. Then I grew up more or less. Much of my childhood faith formation was in and broadly evangelical church, sort of Baptist roots, but ended up being non-denominational, and then came back into the church for a number of reasons. And I think all of them, understandable and maybe most or all of them good. But I think when I came back into the Catholic Church, but also when I came into studying academic theology, I came in with a lot of questions. I came in not really sure what I believed, or at least not sure why I believed it. And so I thought that studying the history of Christian theology, like I knew it would be hard and I knew it would be, there would be surprises along the way. But I thought I would be able to finally sort of tell myself a very clear and straightforward and coherent, like, take on what I believe and why. And I don't mean to suggest that studying the history of Christian theology has, like, undermined my faith at all. Quite the opposite. But what I thought would be a kind of straightforward and, if not easy, straightforwardly helpful way of sorting out my problems and my questions became helpful in a different way, because I realized that the story of the development of Christian theology, the twists and turns of even the, you know, I would say, you know, Catholic and Protestant across the table here, you know, the broader swaths of what counts as Christian orthodoxy, was a much more complex and interesting and and sometimes wild and woolly story that required me to think a lot more deeply, to wrestle with a lot of questions. And so I guess that then that methodological formal answer leads into maybe the substantive. As you know, I've written publicly on my commitment to apocatastasis or universalism. And so the substantive thing is I used to think that it was possible, if not likely, that some people will be in hell forever. And I don't think that's the case anymore. And that, maybe it's a tenuous place to be in, to think that all will be saved. Especially as a Roman Catholic, I've had some people suggest that, you know, maybe I don't meet the cut as a Roman Catholic. I make clear to, anyone who talks to me about it, and it's not something that's, I don't consider it a hobby horse, certainly not, with students or anything like that. But if people ask me in my opinion, I'm honest, but I'm also honest that I know I'm in the minority, and by some accounts, maybe I'm a heretic. I'm certainly dissent from the majority position and the position of the current Roman Catholic Catechism. But it's sort of one of those things when my head hits the pillow at night and my conscience, when my kids, my own children, ask me what I think about this. And I tell them the same thing. I tell them, you know, there's a minority and majority position to this, and there's at least something of a clear magisterial position on it. I have to tell them what I think is true on this. And so, yeah, I think, I don't know if I said that correctly, but that, yeah, you used to think, you asked what did I think was true and now is false.
Yeah. Or vice versa. Yeah.
I used to think it was true that hell had to be eternal. There had to be someone in it for eternity, or at least I think probably more of the Balthasarian position that there has to be the possibility, right, that there are some in hell forever. And I don't think that that's true anymore. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's we'll appreciate you sharing. I kind of want to respond to two parts of your answer. Yeah, to the first part, it just made me laugh because I realized, and maybe I knew this, maybe I didn't, I don't know. But someone was asking me the other day about, like, my educational background, and I started out in psychology as a double major in psychology and philosophy, and I joked, I was like, well, I realized that I wasn't going to make a good therapist because I was only studying psychology because I wanted to understand my own idiosyncrasies. Yeah. And so, like, really, I wasn't actually in it to help other people. I was just in it because I was generalized anxiety disorder and some other stuff that I was dealing with. And I just wanted to know what was going on, and I wanted a better answer. And I thought, you know, okay, well, I'll do psychology. Maybe I get a job in it. But also I could better understand my own pathologies or something. But it's funny because I said, so I realized that I'd make a really bad therapist, which I probably would, because I love to talk. That's why I have a podcast. That's why I like to teach, and write the best.
By people on like me who ramble on and on. So it's kind of productive, but
but it's funny because, like, that's also why I did philosophy, and then really I did theology. Yeah. It's the same thing in a way. Like, I want to understand the content of my own faith and be able to tell, like, I think I like how you said that, wanted to be able to tell a coherent story. And, you know, it is funny. I mean, we don't have to necessarily get into all these questions, but I had multiple people tell me, oh, you're going to Roman Catholic University. You're going to study early Christianity. Right. I know where you'll end up. And
they quote Newman to you, right? To become Catholic, right?
Yeah, actually, I just saw something the other day that there's a push for him to become a doctor of the faith.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I read. I studied with Ken Parker, his essay on development. crazy story. There was a monastery that shut down a few hours from here. I got a first edition of Newman's Essay on Development from the mid 19th century, and I gave it to Ken, and I think they're housing it at a Newman somewhere else. But,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Trying now, yeah.
I was just like, I don't feel right keeping this book. Yeah. Like, I think it's awesome, but someone who loves Newman should have a first edition.
Yeah, that's cool.
But that's fun. I still love books. Yeah. But I don't know, you know, it wasn't for me just an, like, okay, well now I need to be Catholic.
Right.
And some of it has to do with what you were saying is like, it's just is a lot messier picture.
Right.
You know, I'm not trying to turn this into any kind of apologetics and pushing one towards the other or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, but reflecting back to you, mirroring back to you my own kind of journey. Yeah. I thought maybe I would go one way and I didn't. Or I would do one thing and it got more complicated.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you care to respond to that.
I mean, it makes sense on a number of fronts. And Newman's interesting on this because in his own day, Newman was the most honest about the historical, dogmatic, doctrinal, theological record, right? I think you could argue now from this perspective, you know, he tells a story like about the 4th century and about the 5th century that maybe is even smoother than the actual record suggests, right? So the notion that studying history will confirm, I mean, to me it confirms a lot about what I care about deeply about Catholicism and Roman Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But not at the expense of confirming what I see folks who are Protestant, you know, that they value. Certainly folks who are Eastern, by which I mean Eastern Roman Catholic, like Melkite and Greek, Ukrainian Greek Orthodox, as well as Greek Orthodox. I mean, what it confirms is, you know, the truth of the gospel, for sure. And what it also confirms, I think, is that to understand the ongoing challenges of understanding the importance of the gospel and also understanding the shared commitment to the gospel that all of the churches and, you know, in the words of Vatican II, faith communities, but like all of the Trinitarian Orthodox believers, right? It confirms the importance of those central truths, and it challenges us to think about their ongoing relevance in the world today, by which I mean, I mean things like Trinity, incarnation, mm-hmm. You know, eschatology. And it encourages us, I think what it does is it encourages us to mine the tradition in a way that is honest about the complexities. It's honest about the twists and turns. It's honest about the real disagreements that major figures would have had or will have if you put them in conversation with one another. And that's fruitful for thinking about how Christian doctrine in its unvarnished form is a perpetual and ongoing source for greater speculative and practical reflection. And maybe that's like sounds whatever highfalutin or whatever, but it's like, I guess one way to put it is if you go back and you think that the story is going to be smooth and it's going to confirm what you already think, it's going to confirm your tradition to the exclusion of others, you might think that will make the archive more promising for current and future speculative and practical reflection. But I think in fact, the opposite is true. It is the complexity, the wild and woolly nature of it that makes it even more interesting and more fruitful, or at least so my journey has suggested to me. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we had David Bentley Hart on to talk about tradition and apocalypse.
That's his kind of take, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought about that as an ecumenical enterprise, what that would mean as an ecumenical enterprise, mm-hmm. which could be an interesting way, you know, like I found his thesis, you know, at times challenging, at times I didn't understand, but just the idea of the forward looking nature of tradition, how that could be an interesting way to think about ecumenical dialogue,
right?
As like, you know, how do we, okay, now knowing where we're at, not only trying to sort of make a perfectly sound historical argument or something that has, you know, no difficulties, no questions, but then like, okay, so we have to be faithful to the traditions from which we come, but how do we then actually not try to just solve this by getting the history to all line up, but how do we, you know, understand what we're doing looking forward?
I think that's a great way to put it. I hadn't a tradition apocalypse hadn't come to mind when we were talking, but I'm glad you bring it up, because yeah, one way to read that book is to say, oh, David, you know, all the messiness and all the what you think are surprises and twists and turns of the historical record, and of specifically of the dogmatic record, right? Like of what we take to be consensus, like Nicaea, Chalcedon, or I would say going forward, the post-Chalcedonian councils, right? Constantinople II and III. You know, your willingness to suggest how surprising and messy and complicated that is going to lead us to think that we don't know where we're going and we should, right? And so we need to buckle down and batten down the hatches. And I think he's trying to suggest something different, right?
Right.
It's in studying that wild and messy story that's where you're going to find the threads that lead you forward to the telos, right? He sort of says that it's final causality, it's eschatology, it's the truth is in the end. That's what helps you make sense of the messy past and where to go from right now.
Yeah.
And I can see where you could read that book and feel like the tone of it is kind of like despair and confusion, right? And like, I don't know, who knows what we'll believe tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
And I think it all depends on the reader, right? And what you're focusing on. I think it can be read as a very hopeful text, but hopeful in a realistic way, and that one that requires doing the hard work of thinking through the past, the present, and the future. So